Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we've got a classic album dissection of Bill Withers live at Carnegie Hall, 1973 release. We're revisiting that chat. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, let's review the new album from Anoni and the Johnsons.
It must change.
Yes, that was a little bit of the opening track on the new album, My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross, by Anoni and the Johnsons. It's called It Must Change, and it is a emphatic cry for things to get better in the world, Greg. Anoni and the Johnsons, a fascinating backstory of a brilliant musician with 3 decades now under her belt. People may first have become aware of this music when Anoni was recording as Anthony and the Johnsons. Now uses the female pronoun, has celebrated in interviews their transition, an inspiring story. First album in 7 years, back with the band that initially was Anthony and the Johnsons, now Anoni and the Johnsons, and that's A-N-O-N-I. H-N-I, all caps. 2 solo albums for Anoni, 5 with the band The Johnsons. This record produced by Jimmy Hogarth over at Rough Trade Records. It was Jeanette Lee and Jeff Travis, legendary record people, who said, "We think it might be a good idea to pair you, Anoni, with this producer of Amy Winehouse and Duffy and Tina Turner." Mm-hmm. All right. The result is My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross. And because I'll forget to mention it later, who's on the cover? A legendary human rights activist, Marsha P. Johnson, gives us a very striking cover image for this first Anoni record in 7 years. Let's play a track. We'll come back with our reviews. This is called Scapegoat.
Doesn't matter what you go to give or why you won't live. My scapegoat. It's not personal. It's not personal.
That is Scapegoat from the new Anoni and the Johnsons record, My Back Was a Bridge for You to Cross. You mentioned Jimmy Hogarth. This is essentially a dialogue between Anoni's voice and Hogarth's guitar.
Yeah.
It's a very raw, stripped-down record. I was not expecting this at all because in the past, Anoni has... she has sort of made these lusher records, you know, very soulful, but in a kind of a fragile way, with lush production touches. This is a very raw, stripped down record, and I think what Anoni has said, she's been referencing a lot of '80s UK singers who referenced American soul music in their music. She was specifically talking about people like Boy George and Alison Moyet. I'd like to throw in Jimmy Somerville, too, you know, the great Scottish singer, with those sort of androgynous vocals, you know, channeling American soul. And Noni is doing the same thing, much the same thing here, suiting the subject matter, because essentially what's happening on almost all of these songs is she is processing the death of loved ones or the imminent death of the planet. You know, it's mortality of both the planet and people that are close to her. And she's also looking to the future. And I think this is a record that points, you know, It Must Change is the name of the first track on this record. And at the end, when she's talking about, you know, you can, you know, use my back as a bridge to that future.
Yeah.
I'm sort of laying myself down before you. I may not make it that far, but I'm hopefully building a bridge to a better world after I'm gone.
Done my work, my back was broke, my back was a bridge for you to cross.
It's a very moving record. The investment in this record is just total. You know, I was struck by the story behind Sliver of Ice, you know. Great friends with Lou Reed, who championed Anoni very early on.
She's all over the Raven album and had collaborated with Lou several times. Great stuff they did together.
And she's visiting with him, you know, as he's dying, and this Sliver of Ice where he's just talking about the taste of the ice on his tongue, just the, you know, appreciating every moment of the life he had left.
Now that I'm almost gone, sliver of ice on my tongue, the taste nice. It tastes so good, it felt so right for the first time in my life.
You know, can't mourning a dead friend who committed suicide, you know, just the guitar and the voice, kind of, again... I heard a little bit of Otis Redding in the tonal quality of that song, and also Van Morrison, the Astral Weeks record with the ebb and flow kind of arrangement.
Well, you're citing some of the greatest soul records of all time. And Anoni has also been talking a lot about What's Going On by Marvin Gaye in
absolutely. Interviews. I'm just blown away by this record. You Be Free at the end is just an incredible... You know, I'm broken, use me to move on. You be free for me.
You be free. You be free for me. For me. You be free for me.
Yeah, that is her dying wish.
Yeah. No, it's a brilliant, brilliant soul record, Greg. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Jimmy Somerville. I would put Anoni also in the pantheon of androgynous, brilliant vocalists with Jimmy Scott and Chet Baker. I mean, you know, her voice is that good. Her delivery, her emotion. And Hogarth is a perfect partner because in addition to that, you know, quiet, gentle picking of Velvet Underground 3, you know, he can erupt with Lou Reed's greatest noise explosions.
There's dissonance there, which I think, you know, speaks to the, you know, the intensity of the material.
No, I don't think we've heard a better soul record in a decade at least. So that's two big thumbs up. Gee, which critics used to say that? For Anoni and the Johnsons, my back was a bridge for you to cross. As always, though, we want to hear your thoughts. Leave us a voice message on our website so we can play it on the show. Coming up, we dig deep into Bill Withers live at Carnegie Hall.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sometimes in our life, we all have pain. We all have sorrow.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Cott here with my partner, Jim DeRogatis. This week, we're celebrating Bill Withers' life by taking a close look at his outstanding album, Live at Carnegie Hall.
We are overdue to dive into this classic album.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. He made many fine records in the early 70s at the start of his career. But I think the signature record is Bill Withers Live at Carnegie Hall, which was released in April of 1973, Jim. And to me, if you want a one-stop shopping of what Bill Withers was all about, this is the record for you. I also think it's one of the greatest live albums ever made. Forget artists, forget genre, forget about era. You know, this is one of those records that holds up over decades.
Oh, absolutely. And I have you to thank because I had my obligatory Bill Withers Greatest Hits collection, and that was what my Withers collection was. And then you kept drumming into me the greatness of this album. I'm an anti-live album, generally speaking. But what a fascinating story. Let's start with who this guy was. Bill Withers, born on the 4th of July. How much more American can you get? 1938 in West Virginia, where he grows up. As a young teen, a middle teen, he enters the U.S. Navy, spends almost a decade working as an aircraft mechanic. When Bill Withers emerges from the service, Greg, he settles in San Jose, California for a time, has a couple of odd jobs. At one point, he's a milkman before he winds up back in the aircraft industry. And that makes it sound, those two words, aircraft industry, makes it sound way more glamorous than it was. Bill Withers' job was installing the toilets in jetliner bathrooms. probably the least favorite part of an aircraft that anybody's ever experienced. The story goes that he goes to see Lou Rawls performing at a club in Oakland, California, and he is struck as much by the music as the fact that Mr. Rawls seems to be doing very good business that night with a full house.
I went down to St. James Infirmary.
And Bill Withers decides to begin working on his songwriting abilities. He puts out a one-off single in 1967 that isn't really part of the story. But he moves to LA and then decides to get serious. He records a demo with the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band.
Express yourself.
It's a serious studio. It's an impressive demo. One of the band members is impressed enough to take it to Stax Records and begin playing it. He doesn't wind up at Stax. He winds up at Sussex Records. And this label pairs him with Booker T and the MGs for his debut album, Just As I Am, in 1971. Not only has he got most of Booker T and the MGs, one of the greatest backing bands in history, on that record, he's got people like Stephen Stills of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and Jim Keltner, the great studio drummer.
Saturday night in Harlem, everything's all right. You can really swing and shake your pretty thing. The party's out of sight.
But still, nobody quite knows what to do with this music coming out of Bill Withers. He's 33 when that debut comes out. I mean, that's old in pop music terms. The first single comes out with Harlem on the A side, but DJs begin playing the B side. And that's where the Bill Withers story really starts, because that B side is Ain't No Sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
Becomes a big hit. The man is on the map with a third of his life already behind him. The follow-up album is even more successful. It's only a year before Still Bill comes out. That's got two hits at the top of the charts. Following up Ain't No Sunshine, we get Lean On Me and Use Me. Bill Withers is at the top of his game. And on October 6th, a Friday night, he plays Carnegie Hall. You know, the old joke. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? You practice, you practice, you practice. And if you're Bill Withers, you spend 33, 34 years at that point learning your game. It's apparently a miserable night. You know, autumn in New York, they talk about, right? But no, this is one of those cold, wet, dreadful nights, not fit for beast nor fowl. And on Live at Carnegie Hall, Bill Withers is thanking people continually for coming out in this weather.
Appreciate y'all coming out in this rain.
Yeah, it's not a very forgiving night for, you know, the audience, but they show up in droves. They fill up 3,600-seat Carnegie Hall, which amazed Withers and his band and his managers and his record company, all of whom thought it was a bad idea to book Carnegie Hall. Up until this point, he'd basically been playing clubs like the Bitter End and the Troubadour in L.A., and he'd been an opening act for people like Blood, Sweat, and Tears or Jethro Tull whenever he did play larger places. So this was a big step for him.
Well, and there's some hubris there, you know. I mean, Carnegie Hall is the premier concert venue in New York. I found a review from when the concert happened saying, you know, what happened here? Did the Apollo Theater move south?
You know, it was one of those things where the audience became a part of the show in a big way because of Withers' magnetism.
I just call lonely brother.
Now, Still Bill, the second album, had been released in May of 72, and I think what's key to this record is that he had retooled his band by the time Still Bill came out, that studio album with the two big hits on it. You know, he had basically taken the core of the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band, which had backed funk pioneer Charles Wright on hits like Do Your Thing and Express Yourself.
Express Yourself!
And made them his band. So they had been playing together on the road in these clubs and recorded this studio album. So they were quite primed for this show. Benoris Blackman on guitar, Melvin Dunlap on bass, Ray Jackson on piano and strings, James Gatson on drums, the great James Gatson. And I once talked to Withers, and he talked to me about, you know, this band would rehearse constantly. They were rehearsing in James Gatson's garage. And Withers used to joke around with the guys. You guys were the original garage band, you know? you know, very proficient musicians, but they were doing it old school, you know, getting ready for going on the road or cutting a record by playing together in real time in their garage. So by this point, they had developed a real chemistry. In James Gadson's garage, they became a great band together, backing up Bill Withers' Thing. They added a percussionist for this particular date, Bobby Hall, who was just a child prodigy. Had played with everybody in Motown, The Temptations, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson. The one thing I need to add, Jim, here is that besides this amazing band, as we know, there was a lot of sort of gimmickry done with a lot of so-called live albums in the 70s. Live wasn't really live because sometimes the entire album, except for the audience applause, would be recut in the studio and passed off as a live album. In this case, this was very much a live recording, except occasionally you hear a horn or a string part that comes in. Those were overdubbed later. I was disappointed to find that out years ago that not everything was live on this record. It would have been amazing if they'd had an orchestra present in the room, but they couldn't afford one at the time, I'm sure. They did overdub some strings and horns in L.A.
It was Carnegie Hall. You'd think there'd be an orchestra just laying around, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. But it doesn't detract from the record at all. The core of the record, Jim, is Withers interacting with that audience and with that band in real time.
No, and it just builds and builds and builds. The feedback loop, the energy going in all three directions, Bill to the band, to the audience back. You know, I think the best way, Greg, to deal with what originally were four sides of vinyl LP is to talk about some of the songs. And I wanted to start with the opening track, Use Me.
Hey, hey.
Now, it was a hit at that point for Withers. It becomes, as everything does on Live at Carnegie Hall, it becomes something different. It's looser, it's funkier. It's more soulful, more immediate in the recorded version, I think, than even on the album version, which is great for sure. You know, Bill Withers, I think because Lean On Me is such a powerful and emotional song, many people think of him as looking always on the bright side of life. But this is a man who has done a lot of living by age 33. And Use Me is a song that is about a sexual relationship where he feels these partners are using each other, that he feels he's being used. You really do abuse me. You get me in a crowd of high-class people, and then you act real rude to me.
You're like you're getting me among your high-class friends.
Robert Christgau, the great critic, called it one of the few knowledgeable songs about sex that our supposedly sexy music has ever produced. It's also a song about class. You know, now suddenly he's a star, and he's, by all accounts of his life story, he's enjoying being a star. But you now have time for me that I have money and stardom, but you didn't before when I was installing toilets in the airplanes, right? There's, you know, some bitterness, cynicism. I don't know what the word is. You know, he knows human nature. He knows the good stuff and he knows the bad stuff. And we have to talk about Use Me. I don't think he's had a song that's been covered or sampled more. I mean, listen to just a few of the folks who have covered Use Me. Grace Jones. Fiona Apple, D'Angelo, Ben Harper, Ike and Tina Turner, Isaac Hayes, Aaron Neville, and these are my two favorite, Liza Minnelli,
Until You Use Me Up,
and Hootie and the Blowfish. Show me a list anywhere else in pop music that diverse that has covered a song by anyone.
Yeah, it's an incredible version, Jim. It begins the record. You know, I'm not sure where it fell in the actual concert. I find it hard to believe that the concert opened with this moment, because it's almost like, where do you go from there, you know? But it's so amazing the way it transcends the studio version, especially the way Gadsden's drums, the way he would, you know, he'd say, baby, and then you hear that whack of that kick drum, and then baby, and then there's another whack from James Gadsden, and get it, James, get it, James. You know, he was exhorting his band to feel what he was feeling. And there's a reason I think this song resonates over the decades. It's because love songs were traditionally very black and white. It was, you know, you're either in love or you're out of love. This is sort of an in-betweener, you know? And I think that's what Bill Withers was so great about, is just talking about those moments that are in those gray areas, you know? This isn't exactly right, but it doesn't feel wrong. It's like one of those things where human beings go through these kind of complex emotions.
You're absolutely right, and I think that love-hate, two-side, good relationship, bad relationship, toxic mix, right? I think you have to go to somebody like Mick Jagger to reach anything similar, especially in that era, a song like Angie or something, where I'm drawn to you, but you're destroying me.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. And Gadsden, yeah, I'll second that. What an incredible drummer.
Yeah, the band is incredible. I think, again, you hear the performance of that band as being part of who Bill Withers is. I think a lot of people may think, oh, singer-songwriter, plays that folk guitar, and that's kind of his pocket. And certainly that's where it begins, but I think the band just brings a whole other dimension to it on this record. What's interesting about this record, too, Jim, is I think a lot of live albums, and I think one of the reasons people look askance at them who value music, is that they're essentially glorified greatest hits collections. They're not really meant for any other purpose other than to be a placeholder in a band's career while they're biding time between the next studio album. Withers had only put out two studio records, so he didn't have a ton of music to draw on at this point in his career. What was fascinating about Live at Carnegie Hall is that he introduced like five songs on this record that had not been recorded, including the one that I'm going to focus on next, I Can't Write Left-Handed. This was a song that was never included on a Withers studio album, which boggles my mind because I think it's one of the strongest bits of songwriting he'd ever done. But I think maybe he also felt like it needed that audience interaction in order to become what it was.
We recorded this song on October the 6th. Since then, the war has been declared over. If you're like me, you'll remember it like anybody remembers any war. One big drag.
I just love those hymn-like, wordless backing vocals that set that haunting tone at the start of the song as he's talking about this young kid, this stranger in a strange land who was shot in the shoulder. And it's almost matter-of-fact in the telling of the story, but there's sort of a rage underneath that plain-spoken delivery. And he's talking about, you know, the fate of this kid who went over to Vietnam not really knowing what he was getting into and returning without a right arm. And, you know, I can't write left-handed is a simple plea. Like, this is affecting the way I live day to day.
Somebody says go, they don't ask any questions, they just go. And I can remember not too long ago seeing a young guy with his right arm gone. Just got back.
And Withers, you know, this was not a story that Withers had to imagine a great deal. I mean, he was in the military for 9 years, as you pointed out, Jim, and he knew these guys. He never saw combat, but he knew a lot of his friends who did. And this was part of that sort of memory experience that he brought to his songwriting, that, you know, drawing in on these tales that he remembered from growing up and being a young man, in a young African-American man in America during a tremendously tumultuous time in our country's history. So this song is so powerful emotionally, and I think the way they sort of build it up and interact with the audience as the song proceeds, it turns it into this like incredibly dramatic moment in the show, and also one of the signpost moments of Withers' career.
Please write a letter to my mother. Tell her to tell her family lawyer.
trying to get a deferment for my younger brother.
And again, as great as those singles were, I think this may be his single greatest song from my personal viewpoint.
Really? Even better than Ain't No Sunshine? You're going to go with...
I mean, those songs are great, and I love them to death, but I think I Can't Write Left-Handed. The impact of that song is just, it staggers me every time I hear it, especially in this, you know, with those haunting background harmonies. It just gets me every time.
Well, and the humility with which he introduces it. I mean, we have now had, by 72, quite a few years of anti-war anthems. And, you know, Withers' raps with the audience, I think, are one of the reasons this album works. And usually I hate the audience chatter. But he says, you know, a lot of people write about wars and government. And he's almost apologizing for doing that. Of course, what he's writing about is humanity. And we feel the pain of this guy he's singing about.
Coming up, we'll dig into Withers' early retirement from music that he actually maintained. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. And this week, we're celebrating Bill Withers' life by taking a close look at the outstanding album, Live at Carnegie Hall.
You know, as I said earlier, Greg, you turned me on to this record. You know, not too proud a critic to admit it. It was not in my life until we were doing a speaking gig once, and you went on this sort of rhapsodic. It was an amazing, you know, I'm generally more verbose than you, right? But you just went on this, like, monologue that was like the light came from heaven, and it was shining on you as you talked about Bill Withers. And then partly to see if you were wrong, I began living with this album for quite some time. So I want to talk about a song that I think encapsulates our long-run partnership.
Okay.
Two, three,
you know, friendship is a topic that comes up in several of the songs that are on this double album originally. Bill thinks a lot about the relationship in his life, not only romantic, like Use Me, but about other family members. I know you're going to talk about one of those songs, but other buddies, as he calls them, buddies, right? Mm-hmm. And Friend of Mine is a great buddy song. We might have different views sometime, but that's all right. You're still a friend of mine.
You're still a friend of mine. Come on, y'all, to the thing. You changed my cloudy days to sunshine. I'm so glad.
So you and I argue all the time. I think we are still friendly, always. Competitive, too, but friendly. And man, oh man, is that just a message that needs to be heard today, as we are at one of the least civil points in American history. We always have more in common than we have setting us apart. And when you disagree, you can disagree while being civil and friendly. You know, this doesn't have to be. Part of this is like growing up, you know, Italian family, right? You can be screaming and yelling and throwing things at each other, and next minute you're hugging and pass the meatballs, right? But one of the things I love about this is the rap in the middle. Again, I hate stage patter, right? But in the middle of Friend of Mine, this loose, funky version that breathes and just seems to be living and ebbing and flowing. This whole record, every song on this album seems as if it was playing somewhere, maybe in that garage, right, before it got to stage at Carnegie Hall, and will be playing long after. Every song, there's not really like a beginning or an ending. They all just are we caught this little part of it, but they always existed. But in the middle of Friend of Mine, you know, Bill starts doing the shout-outs to the band. You know, on drums, we got my good friend, Mr. James Gadson. You neglected to mention earlier, you mentioned the percussionist Bobby Hall, but as Bill Withers points out, we got us a lady, Bobby Hall, on percussion. My favorite, though, on bass, we got old, cool Melvin Dunlap. Melvin's so quiet, he said 8 words last year, and 6 of those were airport. I love that.
Melvin's so quiet, he said 8 words last year, and 6 of those were airport.
But it's musical, right? I mean, it is not stage patter. It becomes part of the song and part of the... I can't enjoy the song now without hearing that, because I keep thinking about silent, old, cool Melvin.
The vibe here reminds me of like your favorite uncle sitting around the table at, you know, Thanksgiving or something, telling stories. And he's the one guy you want to tell stories because he's interesting and he's entertaining and he's got some stuff to say that you haven't heard anybody else tell quite like him. And that's this guy. He is this avuncular kind of personality that just the warmth in his voice reflects the warmth in his songs, and you realize they're one and the same. You know, this guy isn't putting on a persona. He is this person. And I think that really adds to the appeal of what we heard in Bill Withers' music. You know, we're talking a lot about Bill Withers conversing not only with his band, with his guitar, with his songs, reinventing them in some ways. These raps with the audience, these introductions are just priceless. I think the one for Grandma's Hands is just incredible.
A lot of folks of all different nationalities and things come up to me and say, I dug my grandmother too. And I remember the first responsibility I ever had was to take care of my grandmother, make sure she got everywhere okay. And at that time, I was maybe 5 or 6 years old. And the most I could have done was let her fall on me if she decided to fall.
It's hilarious. Whereas the one for I Can't Write Left-Handed is very somber and very stirring in a sort of troubling way. The one for Grandma's Hands is just celebratory. It's just beautiful. It makes you laugh out loud. You know, he talks about his grandma being a huge part of his life. You know, his parents were working class people. His dad died when he was, I think he was about 13 years old. His grandmother played a big part in his life in showing him things and just learning how to become a man. And, of course, she was an avid churchgoer. He would say what a big influence the church was on his music, because this was not this somber kind of church service that, you know, you may associate with certain kinds of churches. This was up-tempo music at Grandma's church.
He makes fun of the bad church music. He does a couple of bars of not that church music. No.
It wasn't one of them sad churches where you wish you could just die and get it over with. And Lord knows we've all been in some of those.
Right? Yeah.
Grandma and them had one of them churches where they sung, if you want to have me, Jesus, it's all right. If you want to have me, Jesus, it's all right. And at the funeral, they used to have to tie the caskets down.
I think this just is another one of those examples of a glimpse into what kind of a person Bill Withers was. I mean, I want to meet his grandma after hearing this introduction. She sounded like a wonderful person. And Bill Withers, by extension, sounds like a wonderful human being as well. To be able to celebrate his family members in this way and to share so generously of what they meant in his life in front of the biggest audience of his career to that point.
Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass. Grandma's hand.
Yeah, Greg, I couldn't agree more. And I do think that the warmth and that wonderful quality of Bill Withers' personality, who this man was, comes through on every song. And I think it is all the more powerful for, again, this dark shadow that he had at times. A song like Better Off Dead, which is a contemplation of, you know, what is life worth living for, right? Or Harlem, which closes the album, paired with Cold Baloney, Harlem Cold Baloney, right? This epic, more than 13-minute jam. It's essentially, at its heart, a sad song about cold bologna and mayonnaise and bread. That's dinner, right? Growing up poor. You know, that's where I think the dark and the light collide, and he chooses to go toward the light.
Summer night in Harlem.
Essentially, with this epic jam that never sounds indulgent, it is flowing like a really powerful river the whole time.
You know, he ends the concert with this moment, which extends out to 13 minutes. And, you know, we think about Bill as being a very concise songwriter. He managed to get a lot of emotion and a lot of detail into a few short verses. But here, it's about the music, expanding this tale, as you said, of the hard life that it meant. You know, he grew up poor. There's no two ways about it. Bologna dinners were pretty common back then. And then on Sunday, you get the indignity of getting shaken down by the preacher.
Yeah.
You know, so there's really no respite in this world. Saturday night's the one time you get to cut loose. What's interesting, you brought this up earlier, Jim, that he did cut a single in 1967, and that has surfaced on the net over the years. The A-side is called Three Nights and a Morning, and it's essentially an early test version of Harlem, which was the first song on his first album and closes this concert.
Summer night in Harlem.
Now, you will not recognize the studio version of Harlem when you compare it to the A-side that he recorded in 67 called Three Nights in a Morning. That song is absolutely raucous.
Summer night in Harlem, man, it's really hot. Well, it's too hot to sleep, I'm too cold to eat, don't care if I die now.
It almost points in a direction in what Withers' career might have been had he pursued that direction more fervently at the time. But for whatever reason, it was just a studio one-off. He was making some demos, hoping to attract a record company's interest, and never really returned to that style of music when he was signed to his first label deal. But it surfaces in this Carnegie Hall show as this encore, where Harlem, you know, bleeds into that song Cold Baloney, which is essentially a middle ground between the raucousness of that first single that he cut, Three Nights in a Morning, and the studio version of Harlem. So now we start to hear an alternative possibility for where Withers' career might have led, which is another reason I love this record, because it shows us a whole new facet of Withers' musical versatility. If you think you've got him figured out based on those first two studio records, guess again, fella, because this is like, you know, another window into what his music was and what he was capable of with such a great band backing him up.
Definitely the high point of his career, Greg, not to slight the albums that followed. There are some good moments and some forgettable moments. The times are changing. By the early 80s, kind of disgusted with the idea of drum machines and synthesizers and that early 80s ubiquitous glossy production, Bill just bows out. Right? He just leaves the music business for all intents and purposes. That is rare in the history of pop music because nobody retires anymore. Nobody quits anymore. People disappear for a year or two and then come back for the reunion tour before we've even realized they left.
It's stunning. And Withers always kind of framed it in a way like people were so shocked that I left the music business. He says, you know, I did many things in my life. I worked in the military service. I was a milkman. I built airplane parts before I went into the music business. Then it was something I did from my early 30s into my mid 40s, and then I did something else. I became a dad. I became a parent to two children, with whom he was very close up until the day he died. He forged this relationship with his family that he considered more important than any kind of a music career at that point. He'd made some money having hits and then just got disgusted with the industry itself, the way they were manipulating his music. You know, you mentioned that he basically had that run early in his career where he was able to make the music the way he wanted to. Then he got signed to Columbia Records, and basically they started telling him what they thought he should do. And at a certain point, he just said, you know what, I'm not interested in making the kind of music you think I should be making. Either I do it my way or I quit. And most people don't follow through and actually quit. Well, Bill Withers did, you know, which to me, it's still astonishing to me. I remember that people, you know, promoters were saying if Bill Withers decided to do a tour, you know, that would be a blockbuster. Mm. You know, he would make a ton of money and he could make another record. And there was all this money out there for him to do a comeback. And he just said, you know, not interested, never interested, which was stunning to me. Now, can you think of a single artist that has left at the height of their career in the same way that Bill Withers has done?
I was digging into this, okay, because our producers are like, you know, has anybody else done this, right? And I got a list here, but I don't think anybody was at the point that Withers was at. Garth Brooks, of course, sells a bazillion records, tries to reinvent himself with a different name, just kind of gives it up after.
But then he comes back.
Then he comes back, right? Captain Beefheart, you know, had a long career, a renaissance in new wave, and then disappears to become a painter, a serious fine artist selling work that generated a lot more income than music ever did. But he was kind of already in his, like, coda period when he quit. You know, Cat Stevens.
You know, the one thing about Beefheart, though, not to interrupt, but I mean, he was, you know, suddenly he's on Saturday Night Live, right? He's on some late night talk shows. I mean, in some ways, he was more famous with a mainstream audience than he'd ever been. And then he was truly one of those people, when he quit, he quit.
Yeah, that was it.
He just never did any more music after that.
Wouldn't even talk about his music. I tried to interview him. Nobody. He wouldn't talk to anybody. Cat Stevens leaves, but leaves secular music and the secular world and becomes a Muslim, a devout Muslim. I think the closest parallel, I don't know, tell me if I'm wrong, is Lauryn Hill.
Yeah, I mean, even Lauryn has, you know, done tours and, I mean, Bill, to an extent, would do occasional shows. You know, every once in a while, but stopped recording. Yeah, Lauryn Hill's probably the closest.
There's a spiritual connection there, I think, between what Withers was doing and what Lauryn Hill was doing.
Because it all falls down. Telling you all, it all falls down. Yo, y'all can't handle the truth in a courtroom of lies. Purges the jurors, witnesses, spies, crooked lawyers, false indictments publicized, it's entertainment, the arraignments, the subpoenas, high profile gladiators and bloodthirsty.
Yeah, I mean, one sort of landmark solo record and then really, really nothing else after that. And that's true. You know, Nicki Minaj quit. She said, I'm done, which I sort of frame in the sort of the Jay-Z reference pool, like, okay, this is my last record until I decide to make another one. You know, the Black Album was supposed to be his last one, right? And then 5 years later, he comes back. So we'll see. These retirements very seldom last, but in Bill Withers' case, it lasted until the end of his life, which is, to me, all the more remarkable.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone.
It's not warm when she's away.
That is our take on Bill Withers live at Carnegie Hall. What do you think of Withers' career and legacy? What's your favorite Withers song? Leave a voice message on our website and share your thoughts. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Next week, we're going to talk about a great new book with the author, Mark Guarino. The book is Country and Midwestern, about the country roots in Chicago. I think you'll be astounded at some of the information we're going to present about the roots of country music in this city.
It makes Nashville pale in comparison. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.
As done to me, would you believe the kids in Harlan High School voted me most likely to succeed? Now I'm walking on the sidewalks of Chicago. If I buy the bread, I can't afford the wine. Now I'm walking on the sidewalks of Chicago, wishing I had lived some other time. Wasn't here too long before I met her, and the lady really swept me off my feet. She stayed just long enough to make me love her, and now they're sweeping me up off the street. My mama thinks I've really